This week's Sedra begins with the Parsha of Eishes Yifas Toar. Oversimplified and condensed, basically, during a wartime, in a voluntary war where you're allowed to take captives, a man is enamored with a non-Jewish woman, and the Torah prescribes that he should not live with her. It's according to some opinions, immediately, should take her home, and he has to remove, or she removes her, the clothing she wore during the war, which they used to wear and to entice the enemy soldiers, put on some plain clothing, and she cuts her nails and leaves her hair grow, cuts her and shaves her head, and sits in the house for 30 days and cries for her mother and father. And if after all of this he's still interested in her, then he converts her and marries her, and it could be that she'll turn out to be a very fine wife. If she's really not interested in converting, and he converts her against her will, the Torah says no good is going to come from that. She's mutter to him, but he's going to hate her, and he's going to have a ben sora mora from her. And if he decides he doesn't want her, he just lets her go free, can't use her as a slave or whatever, he just lets her go free. And that's basically the parsha. What I want to speak about from that whole parsha is the Zohar Chodesh. The Zohar Chodesh says on the Pasuk, Ubochso esavia ve'esima yerech yomim, she should cry for her mother and father 30 days, yerech yomim, docho d'shevel. This is referring to the month of Elul. In other words, there is a connection, a hint to the motif, the theme of the month of Elul and the crying of this captive woman for 30 days. I want to explain what the connection is and what it sheds light on some of the aspects of what we're supposed to be doing now during Elul in preparation for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. First, let's see what the purpose of this woman crying for her mother and father. There's a machlokus in the Gemara, first of all, whether it means her literal, physical mother and father, or it really means her religion, her avodah zarah. One opinion says that the reason we let her cry is in order to make closure. She has to separate herself from her past and start a new era in her life. Before you can start a new era, you have to close the past. And the way to come to terms, to come to closure, is by crying. She cries for her mother and father, literally her parents, because she may never see them again, and that's now the past. And she has to look forward now to a new life, perhaps as a Jew. And the second thing is to part with her prior religion. Cry her eyes out for what she used to believe in or whatever in order to be able to accept now to be Jewish and accept the Torah and so on. So one aspect of this crying is the idea of closure, of closing the past in order to begin a new leaf in life. Second idea says that she should cry for her mother and father, literally out of honor and respect for her parents. Even a non-Jew, even if your parents are idol worshippers, it's respectful and honorable to honor them because of gratitude, both in life and in death. And therefore, the Ibn Ezra says, we give her 30 days to mourn for her parents. Perhaps they're no longer alive, there was wartime or whatever, and out of respect and honor for her parents, which is a proper thing, and that's based on gratitude, one should mourn for his parents and give them the final honor and respect. And the last idea the Ibn Ezra also says, we let her cry because she's upset that now that she's going to convert and she sees how beautiful a life of being Jewish is, right? If in fact that's what she's going to choose, we give her 30 days to cry over the fact that her parents didn't have that opportunity, that they didn't convert, or that she didn't convert earlier, that she only found about this now. Those are the three reasons why this woman cries in the Rishonim. One, to let her part with the past. Second, to show gratitude to her parents. Third, to mourn the fact that they didn't have the opportunity that she has. Now let's apply that to the month of Elul. Elul, one aspect of Elul is, it's the end of the year. Before we start a new year, right? Tov Shin Ayin Gimel. So we have to finish off this year. And the Shari Tshuva says the following. He says that in some sources in the Tanakh, it seems to say that the order of tshuva is first you regret doing the sin, and then you stop doing it. Those are the main portions of tshuva, is regret, ceasing to do the sin, and committing yourself not to do it again. And then there's vidui, confessing verbally all these things. But those are the three components of tshuva. So says the Shari Tshuva, sometimes the regret precedes the stopping to do the Avera. And what causes you to stop is your regret. But sometimes there are sources that seem to say just the opposite. First you stop doing the Avera, and then you regret. So he explains, it depends on the type of Avera. A sin that you've done out of character one time. So there, immediately after you do it, you feel guilty and you regret it, and that will give you the incentive to stop doing it in the future. So first comes the regret, then comes the stopping to do it. But a sin that you're in the habit of doing, right, you become accustomed to do, you're not going to regret it. Before you stop and get out of the habit, then you may regret it. Somebody who's a chain smoker is not going to regret smoking. But if he stops smoking for quite a while, then he can look back and regret ever doing it. But when you're in the midst of the habit, it's hard to regret something that became habitual. So in a habitual sin, a sin that you've done and become accustomed to, there first you have to stop, and then comes the regret. There's only one problem. If you don't regret it, what makes you stop? So there are outside inducements that will induce you to stop. I'll give you an example. Let's go back to the smoker. The guy's a chain smoker. He loves smoking. Goes to the doctor. The doctor says if you continue smoking, you're going to get emphysema, and eventually you're going to die, so you won't be able to smoke anyway, so you might as well stop now. So the guy loves smoking. He doesn't regret smoking, except now he has to stop, because otherwise he's not going to be around to smoke anyway. So he doesn't enjoy the fact that he has to stop smoking, but he stops. As he gets accustomed to not smoking, he may look back and regret ever smoking altogether. But at this point, it's not the regret that makes him stop, it's the fear of what's going to be. The same thing goes, Rosh Hashanah is coming and we're going to be judged. And if you don't stop even what you enjoy doing, you know that it's going to go into the hopper on your judgment. And that's enough reason to cry and to have closure on the past, even if you don't regret it. But you have to come to a stopping of things that are negative, because the Mishpat of Rosh Hashanah. We find that by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Before he died, he called his students in, and when they came, he started crying. And they said, Rebbe, why are you crying? He said, because if they'd be bringing me before an earthly judge, who's here today and tomorrow he's gone, if he punishes me, his punishment can't be more than a temporal punishment, right? And I could always bribe him or appease him, right? And I would cry. Surely now they're bringing me before the heavenly court, right? I'm going to die, and I don't know where I'm going, right? And God's punishment could be eternal, and you can't bribe him. And he's not here today and gone tomorrow. He's eternal. I shouldn't cry. So the fear of the judgment, and knowing that whether you like it or not, you have to change your ways and do something, otherwise the judgment is not going to be in your favor. So that is an incentive to come to closure with the past. And that's what it says. We make her take off the old clothing that she wore, the clothing she wore as a non-Jewish, and we shave her head and we cut her nails, right, and she begins a new thing. She takes away her past, and now she begins a new future. And she sits in your house and has a new environment, and we try to wean her away from her old environment and give her a new environment, and she cries Yerech Yomim. Now it's interesting, a month can be called a Chodesh or a Yerech. Yerach is from the Oreach, the moon. Chodesh is from the new moon. Right? So Chodesh means a moon, a month, but it's dependent, or it alludes to the new moon. A month, because the moon renews itself every month, so a month is called a Chodesh. Chadash. On the other hand, Yerach, the Oreach, is when it is not full. When it's dark. And it decreases. Comes from the word Yaro Yira'eh, to shoot out. It's a shot moon. It's going down. So Yerach is also a month, but it represents the end of the month. It's a month because the month ends when the moon disappears at the end of the cycle. It begins and appears at the beginning of the cycle. So the cycle is called, both on the beginning and on the end, a 30-day cycle. It's interesting, when we write Exuba, which signifies a new beginning, a marriage, so when we write the date in the Exuba, we write, Shlosha Asar Yom Lechodesh Elul, 13 days in the month of Elul. We write a get, a divorce document, we also write the date. But there we write, Shlosha Asar Yom LeYerach Elul, to Yerach. Why? Because Yerach is the end, and Chodesh is the beginning. When you write a Ksuba, you're starting a beginning. When you write a get, you're signifying an end. So we refer to the month as Yerach. Here also, it says she cries, Yerach Yomim, signifying an end of a period. 30 days that signify a closure, an end, right? And there are other things that could engender and incite a person, right, and give him the motivation, motivate a person to stop doing his averas and change his ways, even though he doesn't regret it. Yisurim, the Shari Tshuva says. Person starts to suffer. So he begins to think that maybe he's suffering because of the things he's done. He doesn't regret doing that, but he realizes maybe he has to change his ways. You get old, right? And you see that, you know, your days are numbered. But it's not only when you're an old person. Even if you're a young person, there are times in life where even young people are considered old. When you become in a situation, we say in Shlichas, Al tashlichenu le'es zikna, at a time of oldness. It doesn't necessarily mean you're old, but there are times that people are young that feel old. Old means you don't feel in control. You feel you can't function. You're dysfunctional. That's called old, right? You're not in control. So there are times in life like that. And there's times in life where the given musr, or like we said, the judgment is coming. So here this woman has all the things. She's suffering. She's just a captive because of the war, right? She is in a time when she's not in control. Somebody else is controlling her. So all these things help to motivate her to want to have closure on the past and start a new beginning. The Rambam adds another dimension to this. The Rambam says this whole idea of Eish Tzifas Toar is not to permit the guy to do whatever he wants, and what's it called? Well, you can't control yourself, so go live with this woman. No. Even in a time when you're overcome by passion, at least try to minimize and function in a way that's proper. Don't take advantage. Don't go and rape this woman, what's it called, just like this. Take her home, right? Let her cry for her father and mother. Live with her only in the setting of a home as a wife, right, after she'll convert. If it won't work out, it won't work out. But don't give in to your passions and function in a way that is totally unacceptable. At least minimize it. And that's why it says you bring her home, let her cry, and at least you'll see maybe she's not so attractive anymore when she sits there in your house and cries for 30 days. Right? You leave her in the living room, you come in and see all the nice Jewish women are happy and she's sad. So maybe she's not what you want. So even if you're not going to completely get away from the sin, but at least minimize it. Don't make it look attractive. Understand that it's not so attractive. So that is the first aspect of Elul, and it corresponds to the crying of this woman. The idea, closure on the past, now you're going to start a new beginning. Same thing. Elul is a time for closure on the past because the Mishpat of Rosh Hashanah is coming up. Elul is the end of the year, and in that respect, it corresponds and has a parallel to the crying of this woman. And that is the hint to Elul. There's three hints to Elul, three famous hints. One of them is Mol Hashem Elokecha es levavcha ves levav zarecha. God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your children. The words es levavcha, aleph lamed, es aleph levavcha lamed, the es vav levav lamed is Elul. So there's a hint to Elul in that pasuk that God will circumcise your heart. The idea being, separate yourself from the bad and now become a different person. That's circumcision. So Lamaisa, that is one idea of Elul, and it represents the idea of stopping the sin, which is one aspect of tshuva, and it hints the idea of Elul being the end of the year, closure, and that hint of circumcision of the heart. Next aspect. The next aspect is that you cry that the parents didn't have the opportunity to convert. She now sees a whole new life in front of her, right? Beautiful Jewish life as opposed to what an idolater's life is like. And she's sorry her parents didn't have that opportunity. And corollary to that is that she didn't do this earlier. So that is the idea of the following. Aside from the din that a person has to face every year on his sins and mitzvahs, and that everybody will face at the end of their life, din v'cheshbon, there's also a cheshbon. The Vilna Gaon explains the cheshbon in the following way. A person spoke Lashon Hara for 20 minutes. So the din is he's going to be punished for speaking Lashon Hara. And God's going to take into consideration what were the circumstances or whatever, how bad was it, how much damage did he cause, how easy was it for him not to do it, or whatever. That's a din. You did something wrong, you're going to have to be judged for it. But there's a necheshbon. That means that you weren't put in this world just to be neutral. So if you don't do anything wrong, you're okay. No, you're supposed to do things right. So while you were speaking that Lashon Hara for 20 minutes, it's not just that you shouldn't have spoken the Lashon Hara, but you could have spent 20 minutes doing something constructive. So not only are you going to be judged for the negative, you're going to be judged for not doing something positive. That's called the necheshbon. So here the same thing. A person, and during Elul, aside from making closure on the negative things that he's done in the past year, also has to wake up and say, you know what? I had a lot of opportunities last year which I didn't take advantage of. And you have to cry over the lost opportunities too. Just like this woman cries over lost opportunities. So the second aspect of Elul corresponds to Charata. Once you stop doing the sin, then you can regret. The regret is not only that I did the sin. I regret that I missed opportunities that I could have had I not done the sin. At the time I was doing the sin, I could have had other opportunities, right, that I passed up, that I didn't take advantage of. And therefore, that also corresponds to the idea of Elul, of being the, what's it called, the beginning of the atonement process. Elul is the end of the year, so it's an end. It's the preparation for Rosh Hashanah, 30 days before the holiday, you begin preparing. It's preparation for Rosh Hashanah, 30 days before. It's also the beginning of a 40-day period of atonement that starts on Rosh Chodesh Elul and ends on Yom Kippur. So Elul has those three aspects. It's an end, it's a preparation for the beginning of the year, and it's the beginning of the process of atonement which culminates on Yom Kippur. And it's significant that it's 40 days. Because the number 40 is related that whenever you have a extended process, the formation of a new, what's it called, the culmination of a new process that causes a new formation is 40. It's connected to the number 40. It's based on nature. The Gemara says that Yetzirah Savlad is 40 days. It takes 40 days for the embryo to form in the womb. Now that doesn't mean after 40 days a child's ready to be born, because it obviously takes 9 months. So what is Yetzirah Savlad? So I once wanted to say what it means is the following. That the first 40 days, the major systems of the body that create or that form, the form of a human being are being formed. at 40 days, the major systems are complete, and now it's just a matter of growth. The formation takes 40 days. And that's what I thought maybe it means. This is years ago. And then I saw an information sheet given out by the March of Dimes. I don't know if they still exist, but it used to be a March of Dimes was an organization in America which dealt with birth defects. And they put out a thing telling women to be very careful during the first 6 weeks, trimester, the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, because that's when the major systems of the body are being formed. And then smoking, alcohol, drugs, or whatever could cause birth defects. Because once, when the things are in formation, then something could go wrong and cause terrible birth defects. Once they're formed and it's only a matter of growth, then it's less problematic. How much is 6 weeks? 42 days. So the scientists were only off by 2 days. The rabbis said 40 days is Yetzirah Savlad. So whenever you have in nature, in spiritual or physical, something that is a formation in a process, it takes 40 days to make that formation. Therefore, the flood was 40 days and 40 nights because you were forming a new world. An old world was being destroyed. A new world was being formed, 40 days and 40 nights. The Torah was given in 40 days and 40 nights. It's a new world after the Torah was given, different formation. The 40 years in the desert, an old generation was dying out, and a new generation that would enter Eretz Yisrael was being formed. A mikveh has 40 measures of water because you go into the mikveh and you come out a new formation. So anything that's a process that creates a new formation is connected to number 40. Therefore, the atonement that is culminated on Yom Kippur is a process that begins on the first day of Elul and ends on the 10th day of Tishrei, which is 40 days later. So Elul is the beginning of a 40-day process of tshuva. And that tshuva really depends on how much you regret what you did. The regret is what takes away the aveira. Just like when you make a nether and you regret it, you can annul the nether, right? When you do a sin and you regret it, it's like retroactively taking it away. So there's a 40-day process of that regret taking effect till Yom Kippur. That's one of the reasons we start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidrei. Because Kol Nidrei is the annulment of vows, which is very similar to the idea of regretting a sin and annulling it retroactively. So that's therefore what makes you regret, not only that you did something wrong, but you missed tremendous opportunities in life. That even makes the regret even more intense. And that is connected to the hint, Ani l'dodi, v'dodi li. Ani l'dodi, aleph lamed, v'dodi li, vav lamed elu. I'm to my beloved, to God, and he's to me. Meaning that as much as I want to make myself available and accessible to God, that's how accessible to me. And if I sinned and I wasn't accessible to God, I didn't bring myself closer, then I lost that opportunity. So that's the second hint, this idea of frustrated opportunities. And that also is hinted to in the L'dovid Hashem Ori. Where's the hint to Elul? Ori, it says, is Rosh Hashanah. Yishi is Yom Kippur. Kitz b'neini b'sukko sukkas. But the most of the time we say it during Elul. Where's Elul in that? So some say the Elul's in the Pasuk. Lule hemanti liros b'tuv Hashem. David HaMelech said, if I wouldn't believe in Olam Haba, right? And the word lule has dots on it. And the Gemara says what it means is the following. David said, I'm sure that there is reward for tzaddikim in the world to come. I'm just not sure if I'm going to get it. That's how a person has to feel during Elul. He has tremendous opportunities. He's not sure if he passed them up and missed the boat. So that is the second aspect of Elul that corresponds to the crying of this woman. She's crying because her parents didn't have the opportunity to convert like she has. During Elul, we cry for the opportunities we missed in the past year, and it gives us the incentive not to miss them in the coming year, to make sure that we get them in the coming year. Right? As it says, Kaveh Hashem, right? Hope to God, Chazak V'yamitz, and if you don't succeed, strengthen yourself and try again. You didn't get in the last year, try to get the opportunities again. Don't lose them in this year. So that is the second aspect of Elul and corresponds to the second aspect of tshuva, charata, what's it called, regret. And it's regret over lost opportunities. The third thing, we let this woman cry out of gratitude to her parents, out of honor and respect to her parents, which is predicated on gratitude, because maybe they died and she has to honor and respect them in death by mourning for them, showing her respect for them. Same thing, aside from a person stopping to do the Avera and regretting doing it, both because he's done negative and he hasn't done what positive he could have done, there's another aspect to a Baal Tshuva. And that is, you have to realize that you benefit from the tshuva process. And had you not done tshuva, meaning had you not done the Aveira and done tshuva, you wouldn't be better off necessarily. That's what it says, Sheva yipol tzadik dekam. A tzadik can fall seven times and get up. And they say it doesn't mean despite the fact that he fell, but because he fell, he can get up even stronger. That's why it says, B'makom shebali tshuva omdim, where bali tshuva stand. Even a tzaddik gomer can't stand. And the example I'd like to give is the following. Somebody's walking along, but unsteady. He's not really steady, but he's up. He's walking. So his status is nice, but not steady. Right? Very unsteady. That guy falls, and he has to make an effort to stand up. Now when he stands up, he's much more steady on his feet. Right? He's made the effort, and now he's standing more steady than the person who never fell. That's what it means. Person who did Averis. Not that you do this on purpose, because if you do Averis to do tshuva, the tshuva could be, doesn't even help. But you made an Averis. Now you decided to do tshuva. So the end result after the tshuva could be stronger than had you not done the Averis at all. It's not a reason to do Averis. But after the fact, how so? First of all, you've learned from the Aveira how to protect yourself in the future. You're a stronger person. You're even a stronger person than somebody who's never sinned, perhaps. Because you have to now take precautions to make sure that you're strong in not being able to sin again. The person who never sinned is not necessarily protected from sinning because he's never experienced it and he hasn't gone through it. In addition, sometimes when a person sins, so he brings out a lot of emotions, abilities, capabilities, talents that he has that he never would have recognized had he not used them for the sin. The sin brought them out. But you could use those same things for the good. Right? He was able to, what's it called, to have tremendous stamina to be able to do the Aveira he was doing. But you could use that same stamina for doing good. So you know you have the potential. Use it. They say that that's what Yaakov Avinu said. In Lavan Garti, I live with Lavan. V'taryig mitzvah shamarti, and I kept all 613 mitzvahs. V'lo lamadati mimayisav, I didn't learn from his evil ways. So I think the Chofetz Chaim says he wasn't bragging. He was criticizing himself. True, I live with Lavan, and I kept all the mitzvahs, but I didn't learn from him how to keep my mitzvahs the way he kept his averas. Lavan used to get up at 5 o'clock and plot how to cheat people. I didn't get up at 5 o'clock and plot how to do mitzvahs. I slept till 5:30. So I didn't learn from his evil ways how to do my mitzvahs better. Sometimes you can learn from your own evil ways. If you see that you have the power to do bad, right, because you're interested and your Yetzirah helps you, you surely could use that power for the good too. So having gone through the Aveira and doing tshuva benefits you. So you have to recognize that too. So Elul is the preparation for Rosh Hashanah. Right, in preparing for the din. In preparing for the din, you have to stop doing the sin. You have to regret doing the sin. But you also have to commit yourself to the future not to do it. And you can do that better by having gone through the process. Now you're a stronger commitment. You're a stronger commitment for the good, too. So you have to be makir tova. You have to have gratitude for the sin and the tshuva together, that perhaps if you hadn't sinned and done tshuva, you wouldn't be better off. Again, that's not a reason to sin and do tshuva. But after the fact, you have to recognize the benefits that you got from this process of sinning and doing tshuva. So that's another aspect of Elul. And that aspect corresponds to the following hint. Ish l're'ehu u'matonos levyonim. One to his friend and presents to the poor. That's the idea of gratitude towards another person. Give a person a present because you appreciate them and you want to show your gratitude. Even an ani, you give him a present because you realize that he's giving you a mitzvah. So, therefore, the hint of Elul is, have gratitude. Gratitude meaning recognize the good that you benefited by having done this aveira and doing tshuva. There's a benefit that you can get out of it, right? It's not all totally a waste and negative. And so those are the three aspects of Elul, right? The aspect of the end of the year, the beginning of a atonement process, and the preparation for judgment. And those are the three reasons to cry. Crying as closure, crying because you regret doing the sin, and crying and regret the sin and you regret the opportunities that you let go by, and gratitude for what you benefited ultimately from this whole process. And that's the three aspects of tshuva. The stopping doing the sin is the closure, the regret is the regret part of the sin, and the Kabbalah also, the commitment for the future, is to take that which you went through and use it to become more resolved for the future. And those are the three hints of Elul. Umol Hashem Elokecha, the idea of circumcision, stopping to do the sin. The idea of Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, that the more I come closer to God, He comes closer to me, so if I don't come closer to Him and I sin and I distance myself, I'm destroying an opportunity. And Ish L'Re'ehu Matanos Levyonim, appreciating gratitude one to another, the gratitude that the benefit that you got from going through this process altogether. And that is pretty much the connection between the crying of this woman and Elul. Okay, just one more point. Just a few seconds. It says that this woman is only captured during a voluntary war. In a mandatory war, you can't take captives. You have to kill men, women, and children. So the Arizal says, and aside from this 30-day period of crying as Elul, this going out to war has another symbol to it. That the greatest war that a person faces is not with physical enemies, but with his Yetzer Hara. In fact, the Mesillas Yesharim says that some great Chacham told soldiers coming back from a battle, now you're going into the bigger battle. You came back from a physical battle, now's the battle of this world where you're going to have to fight your Yetzer Hara. So the fighting of the Yetzer Hara is hinted to Ki Seitzei L'Melchom Alavechem, when you go out to fight your enemy. But the Chora, fighting the Yetzer Hara is not a voluntary war, it's a mandatory war. So why would the fight with the Yetzer Hara be hinted to in a voluntary war and not in a mandatory war? So, and also, it says you go out to fight your enemies. They don't come to attack you and you're defending yourself. That's for sure mandatory, to defend yourself. So you're initiating the war. I think that the idea is the following. There's a Kliyoker who says the following. The Yetzer Hara is compared to a fly. There are many parallels. One of the parallels is that a fly never gives up. You can swat it, whatever, until you kill it, it's coming back. A dog's bothering you, when you kick it in the jaw, it'll stay away from you. Go find somebody else to borrow. You got the message. Flies never get the message. Don't ever think the Yetzer Hara is going to give up. He's always coming back. Okay? So, there's another parallel. A fly, if you have an apple, and it's whole, the fly can't do anything to it. But if you take a bite out of the apple, then the fly can have a heyday on the place where it's bitten. He says that's what it means, lepesach hatas roveitz. The Yetzer Hara crouches by the opening. If you don't give him an opening, he has no power over you. It's where you gave him a little bit of an opening, then he has power. Same thing. If you wait to fight your Yetzer Hara till he attacks you, you have a Yetzer Hara to eat something not kosher, and then you have to, you already open the door. So you already have half the battle lost. You have to fight your Yetzer Hara on, what's it called, on positive ground, on neutral ground, right? Not should I eat the treif or not, should I eat with moderation or not. That's permissible things. But if you don't initiate the discipline against the Yetzer Hara on neutral, permissible things, and you wait until it's a question of forbidden things, you already half the battle's lost. So therefore, the fight with the Yetzer Hara is hinted to in a voluntary war. When you're still, you're the one going out against him, he's not coming against you, then you have a chance of winning. If you wait till he comes and you give him an opening into your territory, then in a voluntary war, you need the permission of a king, you need the permission of the Sanhedrin, and need the Urim V'Tumim. In these areas where you're fighting the Yetzer Hara on voluntary terms, it's a very dangerous thing, because it's not specific halachas. It really has to fit your personality and what your weaknesses are or whatever, right? Sometimes it's good to eat a lot. For a certain person who's prone to eat the wrong things, for him he has to curtail his eating a little bit. For some people it's good to fast, some people it's not a good thing to fast. It would make you not serve the Rabban Shalom better. Every person needs their prescription when it comes to permissible things to fit them. So you need the Melech who gives advice. You need solid, practical advice. You need the Sanhedrin who tells you what's okay and what's not okay. Sometimes separating yourself from permissible things or indulging in them is not okay. You don't know it. So you need the Sanhedrin. And you need the Urim V'Tumim. You need a lot of Siyata Dishmaya. You need a lot of heavenly help to be able to navigate how to function in this world, not where it's clearly forbidden and a mitzvah, but where it's permitted, but you have to make the decision of how to deal with those permitted things according to your specific situation, your specific character, your specific desires, emotions, and so on. So you need a melech, a Sanhedrin, and an Urim V'Tumim to be able to deal with that.